Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're going to be talking about Minoka. It's a from-scratch operating system that already runs on x86 and a lot of different ARM boards. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral. Episode 414, recorded December 6, 2016. Minoka. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of, projects you might not have ever heard of, but might want to download right after the show. I think today might be one of those. Joining me today, like many weeks, is Guillermo. Guillermo Amaral, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall.
Hey, hi, and where are
How's
you speaking
going?
To us? Doing well.
My Tijuana bunker here, the same old place.
Yeah, and I'm in Santa Monica, so let me wave in your general direction. It's not too far away. A little closer than when I'm up in Seattle, so indeed. And so I'm back in Santa Monica, back at ZipRecruiter. This is their week for their Christmas party, which means all the remotes come in. So finding even real estate to sit is a real issue, but hopefully I've got a place to sit after I go out of this meeting room today. And this afternoon, we're going to be bowling. That'll be fun. And then there's a Los Angeles Pearlmongers meeting tonight that's right across the street from there. And tomorrow is like an all hands meeting, and Thursday is their company party, and an all day lightning talk session. So it'll be fun. That's more than you need to know about ZipRecruiter. So let's talk about what we're going to actually talk about today, because this is Floss Weekly. This is not Randall and what he's doing today stuff. We're going to be talking to the co-creators of Minoka, which is an operating system from scratch running on both the x86 and ARM platforms so far. Various flavors of those. What's an operating system? An operating system, of course, is something like Linux or Unix or Windows or whatever. It's sort of the thing that's running behind the scenes to let you actually run your apps and make them all work correctly. And right now, you know, I just named sort of the three or four big operating systems and people that use them. You might also be, well, so there's Linux, which is used also in Androids. There's the BSD flavor of Unixes that came from the original Unix source code, which I'm familiar with all the way back to Unix V6 back in the early days. And then there's also the Windows sort of operating system. And of course, you have your OS X, which is partial Unix and partial everything else and so on. But these guys said, enough of all that. We're going to start over. We're going to actually start from scratch, use modern techniques, technologies. By these guys, of course, I mean Evan Green and Chris Stevens, and we'll bring them on in a couple of minutes to chat with them about this wonderful new project they have called Minoka. Guillermo, what are you seeing in this so far?
I think you pretty much covered everything. It looks that they basically recreated a Linux-like or Unix-like or POSIX-like, if you will, operating system. So it should be compatible with software out there for Linux and FreeBSD and QNX. But I'm not really sure, you know, what else they have in there, if they support graphics and such. I'm sure they're going to tell us in a second, though.
Yeah. I mean, we could sit here all day and guess what we think this thing's all about. I often do at the beginning of each show just to make it a little more fun and also to let our guests know how good their elevator pitch was on their website. But rather than do that, I am going to bring them on in just a couple minutes. But I do have an important announcement before I do that, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it'll be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes along, all you have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. For simple and secure payments, the code you can integrate easily. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. And there are SDKs in seven languages: .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, yay Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. There's elegant code with clear documentation. So Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. You can learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. And we thank Braintree for their support of Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Evan Green. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Hi, and where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from my living room in Menlo Park, California.
Menlo Park. Okay, that's all wave that way because it's sort of north of me here, so that's over that direction. And let's also bring on Chris Stevens. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, it's great to be here. I am also in Menlo Park, California, in a different living room.
Can you see each other from? No, okay, right. You're not.
No,
not quiet.
I'll wave to Evan that way.
Okay. This week east. In geography, yes, exactly. Well, let's start with Evan. How well did I do on describing what I think Monoka is about?
You actually, you did pretty well. So I'll describe a little bit of our own kind of motivation of what we were thinking. So when we started, we did kind of a survey of the major OSs out there. We looked around and we realized the first thing we saw was that, hey, it's been over 20 years since anybody's built an operating system, or not since anybody's built an OS, but since the major operating systems, have been written. So Linux was started in 1991, NT in the late 80s, the BSDs can trace their lineage, all the way back to Unix in the 70s. These architectures that we're using are great, but they are very old. And it's interesting to think about how much the hardware has changed during that time. So, computers of the late 80s and early 90s look super different from the handhelds and mobile phones and IoT devices that we have today. And it makes you realize that some of the core tenets of operating systems today, some of the things that we really value, things like power management, things like serviceability, sending updates, things like containerization, virtualization, network security, these weren't really as big a things or things at all back when these operating systems were being designed. So one of the things that, kind of the big question that we set out to answer is, hey, given a chance to rethink all of the historical design decisions, rethink, the core design of an OS, and, given 20 years of hindsight, can we do something new and interesting in the operating system space? Can we create something different here? So that's the major question that we're setting out to answer. So we built Monoka OS, the two of us did. It is POSIX, kind of largely POSIX compatible is what I'm saying. And what that means is basically we're taking POSIX as a great standard of, like a baseline. But we don't necessarily, it's not like something that we refuse to budge from. So if there are areas that, of POSIX that nobody uses, we may not go off and implement those. If there are areas that everyone uses but aren't actually in POSIX, then we're happy to add that. So like the most obvious instance of that would be getopt long. So like if you see any application that uses like dash dash verbose or dash dash, some option that's not just a single character, that's getopt long. Everybody assumes it's going to be there. So we add that. Oh, sorry. That's the cat.
That would be Watney, right?
That's Watney. Yeah. So we named that cat after the character in The Martian.
Okay.
And my girlfriend actually went to... we went to a book signing and told Andy Weir about it, and he got really excited. And so we sent him some photos. He put it on Facebook. And then so the cat now has more likes than I do cumulatively. In a single day, the cat is more popular than me. So anyway, that's the cat.
Get that. Yes. It's a great survey, great summary to start with. But I also want to bring on Chris for a second here. And how did you meet Evan, and how did you the two of you decide to write an operating system from scratch?
Yeah. So I think both of us really enjoyed our college level operating systems courses. You know, for me, I think it was virtual memory that got me really excited about operating systems. It was so cool that the system was lying to applications about how much memory was actually available. So started saying, yeah, you've got 4 gigabytes of virtual address space when, you know, really there might only be 2 gigabytes of memory on the machine. And so after college, you know, I really wanted to go work on one of the major operating systems. And that's how I met Evan. And so we were working together actually on the Windows NT kernel. But then after,
okay, go ahead, sorry.
Well, yeah. And so we were working on Windows 8 at the time. But then, you know, we kind of got, I don't know, we just went our separate ways there. And then after, you know, a year or so, I got back in touch with Evan and learned that he was building an operating system from scratch, and I was like, whoa, that's cool. So, you know, I had to go join him. It's something I couldn't pass up doing. And so, you know, we went off wading into the wilderness to try to see if we could do it ourselves.
Well, there, you know, we're talking, you know, on the order of hundreds of thousands of lines of code to get something before it even like has like a boot screen or whatever, right? Or maybe tens of thousands to that point, but even before you could even like say spawn a shell. So what's been keeping you motivated to do this from scratch? What problem do you think you're solving for people that they're all going to come running to you to want to participate? And I'm beginning to see that you also have a company built around this to probably even make a living at some point. How are you going to differentiate yourself from the rest of the herd out there?
Right. So I'll take this. What kind of, you know, it's always hard to sell a kernel because, you know, when you're building a website or something like that, you have some gorgeous visuals to show. But with a kernel, it's more along the lines of we try to be really careful about where we draw boxes and where we draw lines around components and where we draw, you know, like thick API layers between modules, where we kind of share more intimate details between modules and where we jam things together into a single area. So for instance, off in user mode, we have our POSIX, you know, compatibility layer. And that's great because that allows us to pull over an entire ecosystem worth of packages. So if you like Ruby or you like Python or you like Perl, we can get those languages, those packages up and running with, you know, not too much trouble because we have a C library there and we have POSIX compatibility. And that works great for some people, but the C library doesn't actually make any system calls in our OS, unlike other OSs. So the C library actually calls down into our native API layer. And that is the thing that is making the system calls and interfacing with the kernel and providing the kind of base operating system abstraction. So if you're somebody who says, you know, I don't want all the legacy, I don't want all the extra stuff that comes with the C library, I just want some like base level functionality because I need to squeeze every byte out of this system, then you can code to our native API layer and potentially, you know, reduce your overhead and reduce the kind of footprint of the system quite a bit. So that's an example in user mode of, you know, where we sort of drew a boundary that maybe wasn't there before to say, hey, how can we both support existing applications and potentially think towards the future? And then up in the kernel, one of our big boundaries is this, you know, so the Unix guys did a great job defining a layer between applications and the kernel. The system call interface allows the kernel guys to continue to innovate, and applications don't have to necessarily be recompiled from release to the release of the kernel, because as long as the system call interface stays the same, applications continue to run normally. And so what we wanted to do is take that same interface and apply it to kind of the area between the kernel and the device drivers and core functionality that they support. So we defined a you know, real API layer between the kernel and device drivers. And we think that a number of things will hopefully fall out of that that might be a little bit different than what's out there already. So one big area that comes out of that is when you get the chance to redefine that interface between the kernel and drivers, you can do things like express power management capabilities. So you can say, okay, as the device, you know, I can expose abstractly these certain, you know, device idle states, and I can expose, you know, the relative power savings that you get from entering each of these device states and the latency costs associated with exiting these device states. And then the kernel or some global power coordinator can actually make coordinated decisions about how to manage power in the system. And we think that's cool because that matches closely with what we've seen in the ARM space, for instance. A lot of these ARM SoCs, you know, clocks are distributed in kind of a tree fashion, or power domains encompass multiple devices. So to really get excellent power savings, you need to be able to switch off like SD and I2C and timer 3 all at once to really get down to those lower power states. And with a kind of global power coordinator in the system, we think that we may be able to do that in an interesting way. And so, you know, that's one thing that falls out of this kernel driver interface. For another thing, it's simply good engineering. You know, it allows the driver guys to innovate knowing that they have a stable API. It allows us to know which functions in the kernel we can restructure and completely tear apart versus which areas we need to maintain compatibility with. So that'll allows us, you know, independent innovation. It allows us to potentially push updates, which is something that we're focusing heavily on, is being able to update kernel mode components independently of each other, so that, you know, you can send updates. So it really comes down to a lot of like where we draw boundaries around things and where the boxes are that will hopefully enable new scenarios for us in areas like power management, servicing, deployment, and the platform customization, those kinds of areas where we think we may be able to actually move the needle with a new design compared to other OSs.
Well, one of the things that I think might come out of this, and maybe I'm misunderstood when you were talking earlier, but is it possible then to maybe have Minoka's footprint even smaller if you know it's only going to run a particular app, like say the WRT, whatever they call those things, the Wi-Fi base stations, really only runs one or two apps all the time. And I'm wondering, could Minoka be like linked like a dynamic lib against only the set of apps that'll ever run on it and give you an even smaller footprint? Or am I totally missing the point of what you were saying?
No, you're absolutely right. Size is definitely an area where we have kind of a natural advantage. You know, there's just simply a lot less code there. There's a lot less legacy, so we don't have as much historical kind of code to pull forward into the code base. So overall, the system is very small and very lightweight. And yeah, that modularization allows you to basically shear off aspects of the kernel or of the system overall that you may not need. So for instance, you know, without recompiling, or potentially even without shutting down the system, you know, if you didn't want networking anymore, you could potentially shear off all of networking and unload all of that code, or simply never load it in the first place. So, yeah, you're spot on.
Is there any specific way for you to know which parts are you going to need for an application in your system, or do you have some tool there that, let's say, if I want to make, like Randall mentioned, a Wi-Fi router, do you have a tool for it to kind of clean out the bits that aren't going to get used automatically, or do you still have to do that manually?
Well, what we have is and this is actually a little bit different too. We have the kernel is aware enough to know how to load its own drivers. So what we do is at boot, we load basically just a few drivers that you need to get to the system disk. So there is no init RAM, there's no init RD, there is no kind of initial system. The loader loads the kernel and just a couple of drivers. And then as new devices come online, we load the drivers for those without user mode intervention. So yeah, I would say like as the system comes up, the devices that you need sort of just get loaded up automatically. And there is some kind of customization you can do at build time to figure out, you know, if I'm never going to need this driver, I don't need to include it in the final image.
Yeah, our current tool for that we call msetup, and so you can construct a config file that says like, oh, okay, include this set of drivers for the particular device you're going for. We've even thought about sort of a web interface where someone can pick and choose which devices they're going to support on their system and which architecture it involves, and it would go through the process of building an image for you. But we haven't yet implemented that, but that's kind of something that we've dreamt about doing.
You guys mentioned ARM a few minutes ago. Is that a platform you're actually targeting? Is it only ARM, or is it going to be like x86 or x86-64?
So we're targeting both ARM and x86. And the reason we did that from the beginning actually was to keep ourselves honest. It would have been very easy for us to just pick ARM, given it that we're targeting the embedded and IoT space where ARM seems to have at least won the race so far. We don't want to count Intel out. Had we designed from the beginning with just ARM in mind, we might have cut some corners and developed, put architecture-specific code in some component that really should have been architecture independent. But we did both x86 and ARM in parallel. And what that has given us is a code base that has strong lines between what is architecture-specific and what is architecture independent. And we put most of our code in architecture independent C, and then some of it is in architecture specific C and architecture specific assembly. And so we don't yet have support for things like ARMv8, x86 64, but we've built our system in such a way that with relative ease, we know exactly what we need to go re-implement to support those new architectures.
Oh, good. Yeah, I've noticed, well, whenever I try and port some things, I've worked on different kernel tasks before for clients. And whenever we need to port something, it's usually something not as straightforward as, just getting the, just replacing the specific platform code, like, as you mentioned, especially on like something like FreeBSD. I did want to ask, though, you mentioned you have modules, right? Is there a specific kernel model you guys are using right now, or is it a microkernel, or what are you guys using?
You're asking in terms of like the overall structure of the kernel?
Yeah.
So currently it is, you'd have to categorize it as a monolithic kernel. So what that means is that the drivers run in the same security context as the kernel itself, which is basically what every major OS has done so far. It would be really cool to try to run the drivers in separate hardware security contexts, which is it's closer to the microkernel model. And it's fairly doable for us. I think we could achieve something like that given the kind of strong API layer between the kernel and device drivers. The trouble is always in terms of performance. If you're actually making hardware context switches, in a single system call, making these security context switches, you sacrifice in terms of performance.
Okay. We do have a question from the chat room here. Sandman asked, what are the base processor versions for ARM and Intel that can be used? I'm guessing he probably means what is the base one you are, targeting for this operating system.
Yeah, so for x86, it would be the kind of the i686 platform. We have gone back to the Pentium specification, i586, specifically to get the Intel Quark. So we run on the Intel Galileo, for instance, which actually does require a recompile because the Galileo doesn't have some of the same instructions that every other modern PC essentially has. On ARM, we target ARMv7 is our primary ARM target. So that is ARM architecture with an MMU. VMSA is what they call it. We do go back to kind of this ARMv6K, I think something like ARMv6KT2, which is what the original Raspberry Pi runs on. So we kind of stretch back to ARMv6. for the Raspberry Pi specifically.
Okay. In fact, you already answered my next question. I was going to ask if you guys actually got this thing running on a Raspberry Pi. Is there anything else you also support, kind of like the BeagleBone Black, for example?
Yeah, we support a number of platforms at this point. So the Raspberry Pi 1, 2, and 3, with the caveat that we don't have the 64-bit support on the Raspberry Pi 3. We also have the BeagleBone Black, the TI Panda Board, and we have the RK3288, which is encased in an Asus Chromebook that we actually have in the office. And then, as Evan mentioned, the Intel Galileo, but that's on the x86 side.
Okay, and what about graphics? The Raspberry Pi, for example, is well known for having HDMI output, and it has a fairly okay GPU in there. Is that something you guys are already supporting, or will that come, later? Or if that is that totally out of the question for this OS?
Well, so with any platform that we get up and running, we try to at least get network, storage, USB, and video if they have it. So there's kind of a text mode frame buffer situation that's going on right now on the Raspberry Pi. So you would see graphics, but it's essentially limited to text interaction. That is one area that we are lacking in right now, is we do not have a GUI. So you're not going to see us, at least today, as your new desktop OS or your new mobile phone OS. The question of having a GUI is definitely something that we are thinking about and would potentially like to add. The question itself is actually a little bit ambiguous. So there's kind of two questions in there. The first question is, can you get some sort of graphical interface up and running? And that is definitely yes. We have basically two things we need to do. The first is a set of kernel changes. We need to allow user mode to mmap the frame buffer. We need to add some ioctls so that user mode can, get frame buffer information. And then some coordination code to make sure that the kernel is not also trying to draw on the frame buffer while user mode is drawing to it. So that's item one. And then item two would be to port something like SDL or some sort of graphics library like that that can talk to a frame buffer. And with those two things, we can get, there's a lot of UI scenarios, I think, that light up when you port SDL. A lot of things run off of SDL. Porting X, I think, there's a little more stuff there to it. But again, X running against a frame buffer is not too big of a deal. But I think the thing that people are often asking when they say, is there a GUI, is they really want accelerated graphics drivers. And that is a little trickier. Part of what we set out to answer when we built this OS is to figure out, is it possible for somebody that's not, a super industry insider or not a hardware vendor to build an OS? Or is there just too much secret sauce and too much errata and too much history out there to successfully build something like that? And for the most part, the answer is yes. But accelerated graphics are maybe one area where that answer is a little closer to a no, just because there's a lot of secret sauce in there, closely guarded secrets. It's also very complicated. So I think to get accelerated graphics, it's something that we want, but we may need help from either, an industry expert or a hardware vendor themselves to help us get a high-res graphics stack up and running. So that's the long answer long of where's your GUI.
So I'm guessing, yeah, you would probably need somebody like Intel to get the Intel HD working right. And I can't imagine it's kind of hard. So I was just trying to see if you guys actually supported that, because I do like to make a lot of video games. And it would, having a smaller platform is always something that you look for. Smaller footprint, faster boot times, the usual here. We have another question from the chat room. Peterson asked, are there any commercial products using it?
So our first launch was actually it was kind of in conjunction with a single board computer called the Gizmo 2. So we sort of officially partnered with AMD to launch that. Other than that, no, there are no commercial products. products using our OS right now, but we hope there will be soon.
Okay. And what about other open source projects? Do you know if any other open source project out there is actually using your base to create something else? I'm gonna reference Randall again and his Wi-Fi router. Maybe somebody created something similar to that, or is it getting used in some other embedded applications?
Well, we open sourced about a month ago, so things are still, it's all very new, I would say, for everybody still. So I think people are just starting to kind of get the code checked out, try out a bunch of different things. We've been spending a lot of time fixing bugs on GitHub and adding some features for some hardware that we're trying to run on. So I don't have a definitive answer to that right now. I suspect the answer is no. People are just starting to get their systems set up and running.
But yeah, we had one guy port his open source package actually written in Perl, and so we're sort of integrating that with our test harness, and it helps us manage the embedded tests that come with an open source package. So, you know, Randall might like to hear that somebody's ported a Perl project over to our system.
Yes, that's exciting. Thank you very much for that. And apparently there's something interesting about Emacs also on this platform. But I don't want to ask that right now because I want to follow up to what we just talked about. So I see that Minoka is a company and has been building this product, I guess, internally for a while, and then just open sourced it only a month ago or so, right? So what's sort of the bigger game plan here? Did you intend for this originally just to be something that you would resell through various channels and be the OS for various hardware platforms? Or did you always intend this as an open source project? And if so, why wait until just last month?
No. So we actually were not originally planning to be open source. We really, you know, it really just came down to like, can two guys build and sell an OS? You know, and make a living doing it. And so we had originally kind of tried not to. We, you know, did that first launch with AMD. We kind of shopped it around to a few different companies and realized that to really get the design and the implementation and the testing of it done to the level of quality that we needed, we had to open source it. It was born out of necessity that we open sourced it for people to trust a platform, you know, because the OS is kind of the single point of trust for the hardware. For people to really trust the OS, they really need to know, you know, how it's working, what's in there, how that sausage is made. So we realized that we had to open source it. And I'm actually really glad that we didn't open source it sooner, because what it means for us is that we are super committed to the idea of open source. We are 100%, you know, on board with open source, because we need that community. We need input on the design. We need people to, you know, help test and add features. You know, we need to hear the feedback of what people in the community want to see, what's broken. So yeah, I guess we are open source converts.
Cool. And so my follow up to that would be that, given that this is from scratch, and as you said earlier, you guys wrote your own open source. Sorry, my lights go off every once in a while. Come on, light up. Oh, okay. If you're not watching the video, you're missing this. Okay, there we go. Okay. I have to wave my hands every 20 minutes or the stupid lights go out, and I forgot to do that 20 minutes ago. Anyway, so now back to my question. So given that it's from scratch, and you guys said that you just wrote your own entire network stack and stuff, since this doesn't have the legacy, the heritage of being one of the existing stacks for networking, how do you know you haven't riddled it with security holes? And what do you plan to do in the future to maybe take advantage of what other people are finding out about security holes and migrating those to your platform, essentially porting the fixes that you may or may not need? It sounds like you've created a can of worms for yourself by doing this from scratch.
Chris, anybody? You want to speak to that?
Blame it on him. Yeah.
yeah. So I've actually spent a lot of time in our networking stack. I haven't initially got it up and running, but I went off and made sure it was performant. When we did that Gizmo 2 launch with AMD, it was the first time we had encountered a gigabit chip. And so, yeah, there were issues in our TCP stack that were preventing us from even getting performance. And so, you know, I will say that there are, you know, might be security stuff there as well. But that's where we're kind of calling on the community now to say, you know, there are TCP experts out there. There are network security experts out there. You know, help us make this viable. You know, get in there, read the code. We think it's very clean and well documented and approachable. And so, you know, we'd hope by clarity that, you know, it's fairly easy to find where we might have gone off into the weeds, you know. And so we were just setting out to see how far we could get. And I think we've gotten pretty far to the point where, you know, the community should be interested. And so we're looking for help now. And that was another reason we decided to open source the system.
Okay. And the original Unix guys were just a small handful of guys as well. I think Kernahan and Pogger and Richie and Thomas and stuff, a very small handful of people. But you didn't have to write your own C compiler, so at least you're one step up on that. And you appear to be reusing existing GNU-licensed tools, like you're using probably compiling GNU-LS and putting it on board. How much user land stuff are you having to rewrite?
Well,
go ahead. I'll take a shot at it. One of the goals of the OS, at least what we're trying to do, is we didn't want to have to cobble together a whole bunch of, you know, different libraries and different dependencies to make a working system. So kind of the circle that we drew around, like, what is Minoka OS, involves, you know, obviously the kernel, drivers, and boot environment stuff. But we also decided to include the C library and kind of the basic set of Unix commands. So, like, the shell, copy, move. We wanted you to be able to basically compile our code and have a very minimal but completely usable system. So yeah, we wrote the basic commands. We wrote the C library, which is definitely pushing out further into user land than a lot of OSs go, and then stopped there. So yeah, we haven't written our own compiler yet. We use GCC right now. And then we leverage other projects like Python and Perl, you know, for their purposes, rather than trying to rewrite Python or something like that.
So you're not going to make a Minoka shell that's completely different from everybody else's?
Well, we have our own shell, but it is a born compatible shell.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, when we talked to some of the initial you know, companies that we were going off to, they were kind of like, why'd you even bother with POSIX? You know, why not just make, you know, the most minimal set of functions to get, you know, the application running closer to the hardware? But I don't think we would have gotten very far without POSIX and all the rich, you know, open source packages that are out there today. And so as much as we like to redesign some things, we do like to stand on some of the well-featured packages that people have already written.
Awesome. And so you're starting from scratch. But you guys seem strangely smart for being recent college grads, or have you had a bunch of world experience too?
Well, yeah, we're not super recent college grads. We've been out in the world for a couple of years. We both got our start on the NT kernel, so that was the first kernel that we were both, you know, fairly familiar with. Have come to learn about other operating systems. I guess, thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. And when I mentioned NT earlier, you might have said ugh. You know, I will give a shout out to all the guys up there and at Microsoft. They were a really smart team that, you know, held my hand and Evan's hand in passing us from college into the real world of operating systems.
Yeah, they are an incredibly smart group of people.
And so now this leads me to, so what's the relationship at this point in your plans between Minoka, the company, which obviously, I guess, intends to employ you guys and pay your bills eventually, I hope, and Minoka, the operating system. I mean, how do you see this going forward, and how are you working to build a community around this to accomplish your goals, like with security evaluations, with more device drivers, with more code being ported to it, with more packages being developed? How do you see yourself going forward on this?
In terms of the community or in terms of the business side of things?
All of it. I want to know how you're going to make money to pay for that. I mean, this is not a labor of love, clearly. This is something that you ultimately, I think, want to make a buck at eventually. And kudos to you for doing that and making it all open source from top to bottom. But what's your plan for that? How are you going to do that?
Right. Well, I will say first that this definitely is a labor of love. You don't get this far building an OS unless you really like doing it. So in terms of the business stuff, I would say it's probably fairly predictable given a company that is open sourcing their core product. So, you know, we offer services in terms of support services and engineering services or kind of a closer seat at the design table. So if you want kind of early access to some of the features we're building or basically to kind of buy our time, we are available to support the OS, to integrate it onto new platforms that you might, you know, if you're a device manufacturer and you're trying to design and build a new device and you want a lightweight OS on that, we can help you get that system up and running, get that stuff ported, help debug issues. And then one of the other areas that we can potentially do is if you are, again, you know, a device manufacturer and you're trying to write a driver, but it's got some secret sauce in there that you're not necessarily ready to open source just yet, we can potentially offer alternate licensing solutions so that you can get your platform shipped, but not necessarily be held to the copyleft requirements that everyone else is held to.
And are you demanding contributor agreements then for anybody that's outside the company still contributing, or are you going to keep it under a general enough license that you won't need that?
Right now, yeah, Chris and I have written over, you know, a million lines of code for this OS. So right now it's almost all just us. And for the contributions that we have seen so far, we do ask for a contributor assignment agreement. So for now, yeah, that is the kind of the burden on the community that we are asking for.
Okay. It's been a very short time, but for being out there, have you had some feedback? Have people started submitting patches or at least discussing things like you probably have some sort of to-do list or bug report list, probably in GitHub since you're already in hosting in GitHub. Have you got a sense that people are actually interested and excited by this the same way that I sort of was just looking at your website, which means your website's actually well done, by the way.
Chris did the website.
Yeah, and we have gotten a lot of positive feedback. I think there are three or four guys that are keeping us very busy, and they've kept us busy for the last month. And we're starting to wonder, you know, whether or not they have lives outside of what they're doing with Minoka OS. You know, do they have day jobs? Or not, because we thought, you know, there'd be a bit of a spike after the announcement, but, you know, it might settle down and we could actually do some feature work. But we're just sort of not stuck, but we're talking to these guys, but they're lighting up packages, they're finding bugs. It's been really great to see that sort of level of engagement so far.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but, you know, you've now got some tens of thousands of more earballs and eyeballs on this, so you may have a bit more engagement than you're used to, but I'm sure that's a good thing. Guillermo had a couple more questions. Guillermo, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, actually, you did mention that you were trying to get this thing as small as possible, right? And somebody mentioned a product, so I'm thinking, will this actually run on something that is not a full-fledged CPU, something like a microcontroller, for example?
Not yet. But we've often dreamed just about how small we could get Minoka OS, and you know, could we run on something like a Cortex M4? But the big challenge that we'd have to tackle there is sort of an architecture switch. So something like the Raspberry Pi 2 runs ARMv7A, which has an MMU, memory management unit, which gives you page granular access control. So you can separate privileged access between user mode, kernel mode, and between different user mode applications. But something like a microprocessor in the Cortex-M with the ARMv7M architecture at most will have an MPU, which does away with page tables. And so you have access privilege protection, but every application is running in the same address space. And so things would look different. We'd have to redesign our memory manager for, you know, context swaps, or, you know, how to physically allocate memory. So if you allocate something, you know, for process A, it needs to come from a certain pool of memory. You can't just get any arbitrary physical address and map it virtually into that process. So we'd have to really think about how to redesign the memory manager to support something like a microprocessor.
Okay, and go ahead.
Well, the only other thing I would add is that I think we would kind of, it's definitely something that we're thinking about. We would probably want some input from the community as far as like, which areas do we slice out entirely versus which components do we try to adapt to an MMU-less environment? So we're thinking about it. We're not exactly sure exactly which parts should be in there versus which parts shouldn't.
Okay. Yeah, cause, I would be completely happy if I could be able to run this on my my ARM Core M 0+. No, I'm kidding. That's probably a little bit too small, isn't it? Are you guys then you guys are probably looking at something else. Are you guys looking at other platforms to support this too that is not the ARM or the x86 platform?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have designs to support the larger ARM platforms. So like ARMv8, 64-bit, x86, 64. There was a little bit of community interest in terms of like MIPS. Or there was another architecture.
PowerPC.
PowerPC. I'm interested to see how that develops, whether or not, you know, more people will pile on and be like, yeah, we really need MIPS or we really need PowerPC, or if that was more of a one-off request. So definitely the architecture roadmap includes ARMv8 and x86 64 at this point.
Okay. Yeah, MIPS is probably a good contender, I would think. It's still used in a lot of routers and game consoles and such. So PowerPC, I think, has gone by the wayside by now. But, you know, I don't know. I'm not really sure. So what else are you guys planning on making for this? Is there a next step you want to take?
Yeah, well, there's definitely, I mean, pretty much whichever direction you look, there is a ton of stuff to do. I want to take a closer look. Right now we use Opackage for our package manager. I'm not sure I'm necessarily in love with that right now. So I want to look at like how package management, build, and deployment works in general in terms of, you know, can you manage a set of packages? Can you do that in like multiple containerized environments? Containerization is an area that we want to start looking at. And then can you zoom out and potentially look at, you know, entire fleets of devices in that same manner as just like additional sets of containers on additional devices? Because, you know, one thing you see is that you've got all these IoT devices coming into your home, and a lot of them run, you know, some of them run full OSs. And then you start to get this kind of panicky feeling about like, you know, I have no idea how these devices are updated. You know, bugs like Heartbleed and Shellshock are coming out all the time. Clearly, if this device is going to be connected to the internet, it's going to be really important to keep it up to date. So it would be really interesting if you could have, you know, one central place where you could essentially manage updates for all of your devices that you, you know, have administrative control under. And so I want to start thinking about package management in terms of those sort of larger goals. Short term, we definitely have a lot we need to do on the networking stack. You know, we need better support for routing and firewalling, and you know, we don't actually have IPv6 right now. So there is just a ton to do everywhere.
Have you guys run any benchmarks, at least for the networking section? I would really like to see if this thing runs faster than, let's say, standard FreeBSD kernel when transferring things or acting as router.
In terms of the performance side, the thing we've kind of struggled is to get an apples to apples comparison. Just like, what is the right version of, you know, FreeBSD to compare against a system of our size? You know, maybe you could help us with that. You know, but we've on an isolated scenario, like in our office, we've gotten gigabit throughput. But, you know, we really need to test those, you know, real world scenarios to say, like, how well do we compete out there? I actually went through and wrote like sort of an OS benchmark for common things like, you know, fork and exec. And we compare pretty well to a version of Linux on those, you know, really core system calls. And so we have that built into our nightly build process to make sure that we, you know, don't regress our performance. So we care about performance, but I think we'd need to really go stress it in some real world scenarios to determine how well our networking is doing compared to something like FreeBSD.
No, you know,
awesome,
I
go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Well, yeah, just I did want to ask one thing though. is the whole OS actually self-contained? By which I mean, if I were to run this on a VM, let's say, am I able to compile software inside there, or do I still need to do cross compilation between a host and in this case the OS?
Yeah, so that was actually one of our first. Well, so our very first major milestone was actually like run Python. You know, that seemed like a good first milestone. And the reason I bring this up is that it actually turned out to be a really hard milestone because Python doesn't cross compile. So to run Python, you actually have to be able to build Python. So that involved porting, you know, all of GCC over to the OS. So yes, you can build on this OS. And in fact, we have part of our test infrastructure. In fact, our largest part of our test infrastructure is basically a set of test machines across all architectures that grabs the latest source, recompiles it, installs what it just built onto a separate partition of the OS, and then reboots into that and runs some more build stuff. So yes, the OS is fully self-contained. The OS repository, again, is a kind of self-contained world. So it comes with the C library and a kind of BusyBox-like setup. So it should have everything you need, yeah.
Well, that begs the question for me, since I don't have Linux running on anything anywhere, and now I'm going to get hate mail from all the Linux people again. But I really don't run Linux anywhere. I'm running OS X on my laptop. I'm running FreeBSD in the cloud. But I do have VirtualBox, Parallels, and what's the third one? The third big one. I'll remember it. VMware. Yes, I have those. And those are x86 interfaces, essentially. Is there like a VirtualBox or VMware download that I could play with this thing in?
We do support VirtualBox and VMware. So we don't necessarily have like a pre-made VMDK file to get up and running. But if you go to our website and download the traditional like x86 PC image, that'll give you a zip file that has a file in it called pc.image. And then in the our OS repository, in the documentation folder, there's a description there about how to get up and running on VMware in order to build your own VMDK file. So it's a few short steps to get up and running on VirtualBox or VMware.
Okay, yeah, not quite as easy as I wanted, but sure.
I know the steps for VirtualBox and VMware are a tiny bit clunky, and that's definitely on us to make better. But overall, it does run quite well under both of those scenarios.
Okay, good. So ultimately, if I had Guillermo build one for me, we could probably share that file, and I could start playing with this in my copious spare time.
It's something the community has asked for, and it's on us to go put that file and include it in the download.
All right. And a few more questions that are specific to this show, then a few questions that are really generic. But let me do the questions specific to the show. First off, what license and then why?
We are going with GPL3 because we – why? We like the copyleft aspect of it. So we like the idea that, you know, we're putting our heart and souls out there. We're making this available. If people want to modify and redistribute it and add to it, that's fine, but we would like to benefit from that as well in the same way that they've benefited from it. So that's the license.
Okay, cool. And when you made Fork, did you get it right the first time and make a copy on write?
Well, yes, it was copy on write, but it didn't work.
And I'd say we're still optimizing that copy on write and fork behavior to make sure it's as fast as possible.
Yeah, fork okay. is really hard to get right because you can create really wicked scenarios in which parents fork children, which fork grandchildren, and then parents exit. So now you're left with these like stranded grandparents and children, and it's this. It can get messy in there.
Well, it took decades of kernel development in the Unix world before they got forking to the point where it sort of sits today in the BSD and Linuxes of the world. So I wouldn't fault you for not getting it right in a year. it's also at the heart of everything you do on a Unix-like operating system. Are you offended when I call this Unix-like?
No, it definitely is Unix-like, at least in the outward appearance. The core kernel is not at all. So there's no hard-coded paths to like bin init or sbin shutdown.
Okay.
But on the surface, it does look a lot like Unix.
And when you selected this, was there anything this was really – is this competing with anything? Or was there anything that was close by that you said, well, maybe we can just adapt that? Or are you really pioneering new ground here?
This definitely is new ground. I think a lot of people that would be trying to decide whether or not to use us would be probably weighing it against Linux or embedded Linux. We had one person that we talked to kind of early in the process who said, you know, you guys should really take Plan 9 and adapt Plan 9 to suit your needs. We did not choose to do that.
Okay. Well, and one of the things is that you got the advantage of that you are focusing on a very narrow set of platforms. And every time you try to be broad, like any of the traditional Unix vendors, you're going to have the issues of trying to be that portable for all those operating systems. I actually appreciate the fact that you're looking at just a couple of platforms. One other thing, before I ask the generic questions, one of the things I really enjoyed about Unix and it actually would help me understand the Unix kernel and understand operating systems in general. And you guys, I hope, are aware of this, but the Lion's Unix V6 kernel book, which is not officially available anywhere, but is available at a photocopier near you. Since this is a new kernel written from scratch, do you ever foresee that maybe like somebody like you guys or maybe somebody else near you would sit down and write an annotation of this kernel so that people can learn how to build better operating systems?
Yeah, I think that's something that we, you know, could do. And we've actually been asked by the community for more documentation. But I think some of the issues right now that we'd have with sitting down to write that is that the kernel is still a bit molten. Bringing more packages online, we're finalizing the design. It's fairly, you know, firm, but it's just still got a little bit of give to get to make sure to write something down in stone. So we don't want to have to, you know, write volume one and then initially come out with volume two because things changed 3 months later.
Of course. Okay, so now for the generic questions. We've talked a lot about a lot of different things. We're almost out of time. In fact, we're actually a tiny bit over right now from what I was trying to aim for. But is there anything that we didn't ask today that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we let you go?
I definitely want to take a moment to just say thank you to the small but very enthusiastic community that we have so far. Those guys that and gals that are, you know, writing packages and fixing bugs and reporting bugs. Thank you so much. It's been super encouraging. It's been very heartwarming is probably a sappy word, but it makes us feel great to have that level of community engagement. So thank you guys so much.
Cool. And Chris, anything else?
Yeah, kind of in line with that, I would say that if you've ever thought about reading kernel code and getting in there to learn how the innards work, give us a shot. I think we've got some well-documented, clean and approachable code base that you could digest in a matter of weeks and not years because it isn't large yet. And we've actually had one user write to us, and he called it Sublime. So hopefully that's a good sign for the community to get in there and start reading.
He wasn't just calling it a text editor.
Yeah.
Hey, I made a text editor joke. All right. So speaking of that, two final questions or else my audience will yell at me. So this is for both of you. Favorite scripting language and the text editor that you do most of your work in?
Let's see. I'll use this opportunity to plug. There is actually a scripting language in Minoka. I don't know if it'll be useful to anybody else, but we needed a little scripting language to help describe some setup recipes and one that we could potentially take to the kernel a little bit longer term. So it's called Chalk. It's, you know, kind of sketchy. it's a new scripting language. So I'll use this opportunity to plug that. As far as editors go, I use this editor. It's ancient. It's called Source Insight. But it has some features that no other editor I know of has, and I've really come to rely on it. So there's Source Insight.
Okay. Same question, Chris.
On my side, I think I was indoctrinated into the Emacs crowd early in college by a grad student I was doing research for, and then I'd say Python because I was doing work in Python as well at that time. So that's kind of where I've stayed.
Okay, well, 1 out of 2 ain't bad. I'll take it. I'll definitely take it. Well, 1 out of 4, I guess, when you count everybody. But okay. Hey guys, this has been wonderful. I think this has legs. I think you're going to go places with this, and hopefully, being on our show here is going to help you out a little bit to connect up with the people that you want to connect up with. So thank you for coming on the show and talking about Minoka and its current state and its future.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a lot of fun. We would definitely do it again.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Awesome. Okay, that was, and I scroll down here, that was Evan Green and Chris Stevens who are talking to us about Minoka. What'd you think there, Guillermo?
Well, it does seem like a really, really good project, especially the that I guess this is like a dream everybody wants to make when you start, working on the kernel, like either a Linux kernel or FreeBSD kernel, whatever. You want to start coding your own. And when you're like me with like really high intensity ADD, it's just not going to happen. maybe a week later, you're off doing something else. But I do think this thing has legs, as you mentioned. This thing should be able to, maybe be a contender in a couple of years. I'm really excited. I do want to play around with it.
Absolutely. And I wasn't kidding about the Lions book. The Lions book was the first. I mean, I'm a street trained programmer, so I read the Lions book in a good long rainy afternoon, of which in Oregon there are plenty of, so that's really not an issue finding one of those. But somebody had a copy of a dog-eared copy of the Lions book, and I've just told by in the chat room, by the way, by Rorks, that you can actually order it now still from Amazon. So that if you go there, you can pick it up. But I tell you, being able to completely study a fully functional kernel from top to bottom in a good long afternoon is amazing. It's something that I think everybody who's a Unix user, or programmer, sorry, not just a user, but a programmer who's calling these system calls ought to do something like read the Lions book, or if these guys get their act together also and get some more text out about that, to really understand what's happening on the other side when you're making these calls to syscalls and ioctls and things like that. What's really happening on the operating system? Why is fork so hard to get right? That was a very specific question, because I know that that's a tricky thing to do. So anyway, I could go on forever, but we're almost out of time. Anything final, Guillermo, before I go through the upcoming guests?
No, go ahead.
All right, so here we go. So we got Koala coming up next week with a C, not a K. We're not going down under for that. It's linting and fixing code for all languages. So it's really great if there are tools that can help you rewrite your code to make it better, or tools just sort of point out that something's wrong, like lint. This will be sort of a universal thing. So you can run over your entire project. You go, your makefile's broken this way, and your C code is broken that way, and your Perl code kind of sucks because of this, and it'll just figure out what to do right. Twine after that, which is are writing your own little maze, which twisty, tiny passages all alike. So we had Interactive Fiction on a few weeks ago. This is going to be the follow-up show to that, talking about how to actually write this stuff. A really nice web interface that's hosted by them, or you could have it bring it down yourself. Just added to the schedule, just sometime in the last week or so, we added FreeDOS, which is exactly as it sounds. It's DOS, but it's free. So you can run all those old DOS games that you have sitting gathering dust on media that you probably can't read. I wonder how you get that stuff in. Okay, OpenHMD, which is head-mounted displays. OpenNMS, which is carrier-grade network monitoring, are the two successive shows after that. Just also added to the schedule just in the last week or so. PG Backrest, which sounds like it's some sort of special, like, you know, PG-rated thing you lean against. No. It's Postgres Backup and Restore. And so we've got that's coming up. And it's online backup. So it basically allows you to be able to do your backups while you're ongoing. Eclipse Che, right after that, which is developer workspace server and cloud IDE stuff, Code Envy, things like that. We have some more slots open in Q1, so I'm going to be doing a little more email, sending it out, and getting that filled in. If you go to twit.tv/floss, that's the homepage for the show. You can see the big spreadsheet linked from there. If you have any other suggestions for shows we aren't covering yet or not in that list already, again, here's how to get it on. I got to repeat this every show because some guys don't apparently listen. You don't just tell me about the project. You have the project leader or the community coordinator email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. That address is on the homepage for the show, twit.tv/floss. That's the way to get them on the short list for this show. I guess the caffeine's finally kicking in. This is good. We have a live stream 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays, which is when we tape at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions from the chat room for today's show. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus, and that tweets over to @FlossWeekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus, and that tweets over to Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, and also to Facebook. So everything I do on Google Plus, which is where I source things, goes to all the other places that I tend to be social. I am almost certainly going to be I'm definitely going to be at Yapsi, and probably going to be at OSCON, almost certainly going to be at OSCON. Hopefully at DragonCon, just put on my application last week. Hopefully also at Fizzlay down in Brazil, Porto Alegre, started with a P somewhere in
there.
Also, I've just been made aware that FOSDEM is going to have a lot of Perl content there. I'm going to have to get my act together really quick because it's coming up in February. But if I can manage it, I'm also going to go to FOSDEM for the first year this year. Any quick plugs from you, Guillermo, before we wrap this up?
I guess just two things. My Twitter is GAMARAL. You can just look for that. I also have a YouTube channel, which I'm planning to do a 12 days of STEM. So it's going to be STEM-based videos on my YouTube channel. You can either just Google my name or go to my Twitter, and I'll have a link there that'll send you to my channel. That's it.
Awesome. Okay. And thank you once again for joining us. It's me. You're joining me, but you're joining us, I guess. You're joining me and John and everybody else there. All the producers behind the scenes and making all that stuff happen. But we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.